This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week, I'm going to be talking about the new films, The Visit, The Perfect Guy, which is not my autobiography, 90 Minutes in Heaven, which is also not my autobiography, Listening, which is also not my autobiography, you can ask that of my wife, and Contracted, Phase 2, and then finally, Welcome to Leith, an interesting documentary that's sort of chilling to the bone. There's also going to be some news, the trailer park, some box office predictions, and of course, the world-famous DVD roundup, but first, some paperwork. If you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And you can also reach out to me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
What is a week of news without talking about Batman versus Superman? Dawn of Justice. I generally don't want to talk too much about this movie because I feel like I'm just burning through all of the thoughts on it before it even comes out. I mean, we're like, what, 6 months until this thing comes out? But there's been a couple interesting pieces of news that go beyond just rumor and speculation. And the story is that apparently Warner Brothers executives have been wanting to fine-tune the movie to be more about Batman than Superman. And some people are getting kind of irritated with that because they're like, oh, let Batman have his own movies. And what about this new Batman movie that's coming out? But this is becoming less and less of a Superman movie ever since it was announced, because this was originally supposed to be Man of Steel 2. And once they decided to do Batman versus Superman, yeah, Batman's name came first, but I think it just flows better. But as they went more and more into it, you realize Superman's taking a secondary role. It's much more of a Batman movie. And that makes sense because Warner Brothers has that one property that has been consistent for the most part. And Superman has been very inconsistent, with the exception of the first Superman movie back in 1978. It's been a rocky road for the Superman films. And in fact, Man of Steel, for as well as it did, yeah, I know it made almost $700 million worldwide. And, you know, and I got a friend who listens to this show, and he's not going to like what I have to say here. That's kind of low for one of the top hitters in the DC universe. If you say list just superheroes you know, most people are going to start off with Batman and Superman. And then they'll throw in Spider-Man and the Incredible Hulk. And now they'll throw in Iron Man. Sure, Captain America, but those are your main characters, and Batman and Superman should be pulling in the biggest bucks. It's the same reason why the Amazing Spider-Man series, even though they made money, they were considered in trouble because they're Spider-Man. They should be doing better than what they were doing. They should be billion-dollar movies, and they weren't. And yeah, Superman Returns had come out 7 years before this, and that kind of double-killed the franchise because it had been killed before with Superman 4. It's kind of mind-numbing to realize that this was not a mega hit. And I think that it plays to the fact that Superman movies are much harder to do than Batman. Batman's easier because he's got a much darker side. There's more conflict. There's more richness to the character. Superman's a Boy Scout. That's always been tough to do. So these numbers, these $500, $600, $700 million numbers worldwide can work for Thor and Ant-Man, but they really can't work for the Dark Knight movies, and they shouldn't work for Superman. So that's why the executives are trying to do a little bit more with Batman in this. Another piece of news that I found interesting is Anne Hathaway apparently had come out in the last week or so complaining about there not being enough roles for women. Would we hear this all the time? I mean, gosh, you had Patricia Arquette basically complaining about it in her Academy Award speech, which she could do. That was her time. She could do whatever she wanted to. She wanted to sell Amway during her acceptance speech. She could have done that. But Anne Hathaway's basically talking about the fact that she's losing roles to younger actresses in their 20s. And she admits what I'm going to say here, but she did the same thing. She was taking roles from older actresses when she was in her 20s. That's just how the business works. Sort of like when you know somebody who's really, really attractive and they're young and they're hot and they got youth on their side and they're in their early 20s and like, and then they suddenly get older and they realize they don't have that on their side. And that's when their eyes are open and like, oh, I didn't realize that I was kind of being a jerk when I was younger and attractive. Not that Anne Hathaway was being a jerk, but this is nothing new. Since when is it a surprise that younger actresses steal parts from older actresses? This has always been the case. This is Hollywood. This is how Hollywood has worked since the beginning. I mean, since the days of Bogie and Bacall, they had a 25-year age difference. And that was in, what was that, the 50s? This is nothing new. Younger actresses tend to be what people want on the screen. And part of the problem is actresses don't like their characters to age because there really aren't very many roles for women in their 40s because those tend to be the mother. And Goldie Hawn once said something to the effect of, first you play the ingenue, then you play the housewife, and then you play the mother-in-law. And that is the progression. That is just the way people watch movies. And what happens is you have actresses who are in their 40s who still want to play 20. And that's not just actresses. You can see that last week with Walk in the Woods, where you had Robert Redford, who's pushing 80, trying to play a guy in his late 50s. It's just ludicrous at that point. Ultimately, actresses and actors in general, they just need to realize what they can play by how they look and how they work. For example, Sandra Bullock and Tim McGraw were both in their mid-40s when they played parents in The Blind Side in 2009. Many actors probably didn't want that role because they didn't want to be the mom of a kid in high school or college, not just the mom of babies. But you look at your Facebook feed, most of the women in their late 30s or early 40s are parents, and sometimes parents of teenagers. This is the way the world works, and this is the way Hollywood works. So, yeah, I have sort of sympathy for Anne Hathaway, but guess what, Anne Hathaway? You got to start playing a woman in your late 30s or early 40s, and that's coming up soon. That's just the way the world works. One final piece of news, and this is very quick. Apparently, Danny Boyle, who's one of my favorite directors, is going to be doing a Trainspotting sequel for his next film. I'll stop you right there. Trainspotting, they're all dead from heroin overdoses. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit really quickly is The Danish Girl, and it stars Eddie Redmayne as a man who wants to get a sex change in the early 1900s.
Exactly what happened last night?
There was a moment when I wasn't me. There was a moment when I was just Lily.
But Lily doesn't exist. We were playing a game.
Something changed. I think Lily's thoughts. I dream her dreams. She was always there.
The fact is, I believe that I'm a woman.
And I believe it too.
While this looks like an interesting movie, it's directed by Tom Hooper, who of course did Les Miserables and he did The King's Speech. I mean, he's a very well-respected director. It's got a great cast. This just feels like such a Oscar bait movie. And Eddie Redmayne won the Oscar last year, and the Academy doesn't like to give it out to the same person in the row. I think the only time Spencer Tracy did it, and Tom Hanks did it when he had the 1-2 punch of Philadelphia and then Forrest Gump. Now, of course, you got politics on your side because this is, of course, about transgenders, and it's a popular topic now. You've got the whole Caitlyn Jenner news media circus. But will that be enough to propel Eddie Redmayne or the movie itself or anybody else in it to Oscar, or are we going to get the same response that we had when Selma came out last year, which was a great movie and in fact far superior to 12 Years a Slave, but no one wanted to vote for it? Is Eddie Redmayne's Oscar from last year going to kill his chances? I predict that his Oscar for The Theory of Everything is going to do more damages to his Oscar chances this year than Jupiter Ascending ever would. The next trailer I want to hit is Krampus. Opens on December 4th. It's directed by Michael Dougherty, who did Trick or Treat, and it's a horror movie for Christmas.
Saint Nicholas is not coming this year. Instead, a much darker ancient spirit.
Those are hooves. Elk or a goat? What
kind of goat walks on its hind legs?
His name is Krampus. He is the shadow of Saint Nicholas.
I'm looking forward to this simply because I think Trick or Treat's a lot of fun. And Michael Dougherty kind of got shafted with that because it was too violent. It had violence happening to kids. I mean, in a horror movie, it was rated R. But Warner Brothers was really nervous about releasing it. Oh, they're going to release Krampus. I mean, this is a real legend for Germanic-speaking cultures. And it looks like he's doing a really good rendition of it. And, you know, eat your heart out, Tim Burton, because this may top the creepy imagery from The Nightmare Before Christmas. Looking forward to this one. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Perfect Guy and Welcome to Leith. Because we can't. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
My shirt, too sexy for my shirt, so sexy it hurts.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the movie review segments. Well, sort of. This actually isn't a movie review of this movie. The Perfect Guy, I'll just play the trailer and then I'll talk about it. The Perfect Guy, after breaking up with her non-committal boyfriend, a woman soon learns that her new boyfriend can be dangerous and violent.
I want a husband and children.
I'm just not ready.
I can't wait for you anymore.
No man in your life?
Not anymore.
Shine bright like a diamond.
It shouldn't be so hard.
You're right.
It's simple.
It was like a switch went off.
You know I never hurt you, right?
Do I?
Leah, open the door!
This is almost a repeat of what happened last year with No Good Deed. That one starred Taraji P. Henson and Idris Elba. This one stars Sana Lathan and Morris Chestnut and Michael Ealy. Why I say it's a repeat is because it kind of is the same kind of movie. It's a primarily African-American cast, and it's a domestic violent thriller. Opening in middle of September by Screen Gems. Neither one allowed press to see this movie. In fact, last year, No Good Deed made some news for the fact that it pulled the press screens. I actually had a ticket to go see this, and I was told you can't go. But they said, oh, we don't want to have to give away plot twists. No, BS. You just didn't want crappy reviews. Now, Screen Gems is a part of Sony, and I think we're still trickling through all of the Sony hack issues, because Sony has not screened very well this year. But I think Sony is still reeling from the hack, so they want any movie to be a hit that can be a hit. And so far, some of their movies aren't doing well. They've got everything pinned on Spectre because Pixels was a little bit of a disappointment. It's not been a strong year for Sony, and Sony is reeling from that fallout from last year. Now, with that said, what's interesting about this movie is it looks like it's going to be completely critic-proof anyways. I don't understand why they don't screen these movies. I guess if they don't want to spend the money, but here's what's interesting. They killed all the Thursday night previews too. And that's rare. Usually, the way movies work, they all open on Friday, and sometimes some theaters will run them starting as early as 7, and they do it a lot more now because it's a push-button system. You don't need union projectionists, so you don't have to pay them time and a half. Any idiot with a finger can push the button and start the movie. But when they explicitly say, we're not going to let you show this movie on Thursday night, that's usually a problem. The last time I remember that happening was Vampire Academy. And it always ends up happening in like August or September. This is a bad time for movies. So they're scared of the responses. They're scared of replies. What I find interesting about this movie is all the entire cast, which is, they're a fantastic looking cast, by the way. Morris Chestnut, Michael Ealy, and Sana Lathan. I always had a thing for her. They're all in their 40s. So all this talk earlier about Anne Hathaway saying there are no good roles for women, and well, there are. Sana Lathan's got one. I don't know if it's a good role, but it's a lead role. The three main characters are in their 40s, all look good. None of them look like they're in their 40s. So it's a mature adult thriller, and it may be terrible. I'm not going to see it because I wasn't afforded a chance. I wasn't even afforded a chance to go see it and pay for it. So ultimately, it's a preemptive suck because it has to be. They're trying to recreate what happened last year. I don't know if they're going to be able to recreate with Idris Elba, but he was a much bigger star than either Chestnut or Ely is. And I think that helped propel that movie. But this one's probably going to do decently, partly because it just doesn't have a whole lot of competition out there. But still, it gets a preemptive suck because I'm contractually obligated to.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Welcome to Leith. A group of white supremacists attempt to take over the government of a small town of only a couple dozen people in North Dakota.
When he first got here, he turned around and asked me, did we have any land for sale?
I had no idea what his ultimate plan was.
well-known white supremacist Craig Cobb plans to turn Leith into a white nationalist community.
Here we can gather together and become a simple majority by legal electoral rights.
We live here, we breathe here, our kids grow up here.
This is a fascinating story on many different levels, and it's one of the better documentaries I've seen this year, mainly because it does a really good job at being out of the argument. A lot of times in documentaries, people are obviously coming with a standpoint, and I mean, it's clear that the people who made Welcome to Leith are not fans of the white supremacists, which is a good thing, because those people are bonkers. But they don't get overly judgmental. They show the footage, and they let the footage speak for themselves. And when this guy, Craig Cobb, is running around yelling racial and insults at people and walking around town with an automatic weapon and causing problems, that speaks for itself. So you don't have to work to make that guy look like a nut job or the people he's with. His sort of his sidekick is the walking, talking stereotype of what you would expect a white supremacist to be. It's a fascinating movie because it's true. This really happened. It's a town, and there's like 24, 26 people who technically live there in the town limits. So it has a mayor, but it doesn't have a police office. I mean, it has the sheriff, the county sheriff covers them. But that's it, just like a couple dozen people, including the children. And so what the plan was to go to this town, have more white supremacists move in, and eventually just populate the town. All you needed was, you know, six or seven families, and boom, suddenly you have a voting majority. And that's terrifying, because what they were doing was not illegal. Now, of course, you would have to play this out in your head. If they were successful in this, local law can't trump federal law. If the federal law says you can't discriminate, they can't suddenly say, well, in Leith, we're going to say you can't live here if you're black. You can't do that. There are certain federal laws that are not left up to the states or local municipalities. So there would be lots of problems. The people there didn't want anything to do with this group of folks, but, you know, they legally purchased the property and they started to move in. And it's this interesting chess game of how to get them out, but also not violating what they stand for anyways, because after all, they want to get rid of these people because of who they are and what they believe, which is kind of what the white supremacists want to do. I'm not equating them. I'm not saying that they have the same level, but the point being is a white supremacist doesn't like people because of their beliefs and because of who they are. And you can't make laws in that local town to say, well, we can't have you here if you're a white supremacist. You can't be a thought police to them. You can't say you can't be here if you're a white supremacist. Like I said, it's a little bit of a chess match of how they dealt with this problem because they couldn't violate the law themselves. You can't stop somebody from buying property. So, you know, looking at loopholes and that sort of thing. Ultimately, what it is these people are very scary people. But they're not terribly clever. And the last thing you want is a crazy whack job who's very, very clever. Because this guy's not clever. He thinks he's clever. And he's smart. Apparently, he's got a real high IQ, the guy who orchestrated this. But he's kind of an idiot. Because if he was really smart, he would have moved in, been very quiet about it, had other people move in, had them be very quiet about it, and then, boom, then show your colors and take over the government. But you weren't able to do that because he couldn't hold himself back. He had this great plan and it could have worked, but he was too much of an idiot to really make it work. And you can see that crumbling from the beginning, but it's terrifying to watch. It's a fascinating documentary. And like real life, it doesn't have any sort of easy answers. So it's not terribly satisfying when you get to the end, but that's life. That's the way it is. I mean, you can always Google search Leith, North Dakota, and you'll come up with the story and you're going to know what happens in the movie, but it's definitely worth seeing because it puts you in that position of what would you do? Also, keep in mind that there's no real crime that's been committed. So I'm going to say Welcome to Leith totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. The next movies I'm going to be talking about are M. Night Shyamalan's The Visit and 90 Minutes in Heaven.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing on with the movie reviews. Let's talk about The Visit. This is from M. Night Shyamalan. A brother and sister visit their grandparents for a week, only to discover their insane and dangerous behavior.
My parents asked if their grandchildren could visit them for a week.
I've wanted to spend time with you for so long.
I have not seen your Nana this happy in years. Bedtime here is 9:30. It's probably best you two shouldn't come out of your room after that. See you in the morning.
It's 10:47. We think there's someone outside the door.
There's something wrong with Nana and Papa.
Now, I will admit, I am a big M. Night Shyamalan fan, or I was. I love The Sixth Sense. I wasn't a huge fan of Unbreakable, but I loved Signs. I even liked Lady in the Water, and I thought The Happening was a lot of fun. It was silly, but I really enjoyed The Happening. I like his sort of Twilight Zone type of movies. He's just a pulp director, and that's all he was. Now, once he started doing sci-fi epic movies like The Last Airbender or After Earth, both of which were terrible and made my top 10 worst list of those years, I kind of lost interest. And I remember when he went back and he had written the movie Devil, which was about the elevator. And that was actually really a good movie. He didn't direct it, but it was kind of his story. This is him kind of dipping back into that well. Going in, I was a little bit mixed because on one hand, I wanted to see M. Night Shyamalan do a horror movie again, do a straightforward, weird little thriller, Twilight Zone-esque horror movie. But then again, it's also found footage. And I'm not going to go off on a big rant again about how much I hate found footage and why. Suffice it to say, I thought that the found footage was completely unnecessary. Ultimately, you have less of a story with found footage because you're repeating the same thing and you're doing sort of inane dialogue to make a point as opposed to dialogue that drives the plot and characters. I honestly think that this movie would have been better off not as a found footage movie. It may have been a little easier to take because I just kind of found myself bored. I was bored because there was nothing to the characters. It was just them stumbling onto things and talking about something and then, oh, hey, look at this. As opposed to actually having driven characters with an arc and some sort of complexity and some sort of depth. Because you don't get depth with a found footage movie. You get in your face OMG horror, and I'm not into that. There were several times where I'm watching the movie and I'm like, why is it necessary for them to have cameras in this scene? The found footage as a framing device, I think, was a detriment to this movie. Although when I went to go see it in the theater, it was actually kind of full with a bunch of teenagers. It was a 7 o'clock show. So, you know, heck, maybe it helps. It's going to help the box office, which is terrible because I just want that to die. Ultimately, it has an interesting setup. But like the first, and I counted, the first hour and 7 minutes is just boring. And it has some interesting things that happen, but overall, it's just kind of boring. Stuff happens, but nothing that you wouldn't have gathered from watching the trailers a couple times. After about an hour and 7 minutes, then suddenly it gets interesting. It suddenly gets very, very interesting for about 5 minutes. Then it gets silly for a couple minutes. Then it gets tedious. Then it gets really stupid. Then there's the big reveal. And then it's just sort of pedantically ending. It kind of goes off the rails at the end, not in a good way. So I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed because I do like Shyamalan's work. I do think he's a talented director. And I think that there's a lot that he can bring to a movie. And he did not bring it in this movie. The Visit has some great ideas. It's not as high concept as his other stuff. It's not as high concept as The Sixth Sense or Unbreakable or Lady in the Water or Happening or Signs. It's very straightforward and kind of like a let's just say an underwhelming surprise. Of course, everything of his that he does has a big surprise ending or big twist. This is somewhat underwhelming. And I think part of that's just the framework he used, being the found footage. It's still not a good movie because there's only like 5 minutes of real interesting stuff in there and all the rest is either boring, silly, or stupid. In the end, The Visit kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's move on to the next film. And that is 90 Minutes in Heaven. A man dies in a car crash and is left on the road for 90 minutes, after which he wakes up and insists he went to heaven.
On January 18th, 1989, I died. When I woke up, I was in heaven.
God, please help us.
It was going to be tough, but Don needs you now.
I fought all I can. I'm ready to die.
You got all these people who care so much for you, and you have no idea how much they love.
This is obviously a faith-based movie, and we already have one in the theaters right now, The War Room, which has actually been doing extremely well. Alex Hendrick has directed. He's the guy who did Fireproof and Courageous. While I was not a big fan of Fireproof, I can't speak on Courageous. I didn't see that. I haven't seen The War Room either. But we've got another faith-based film. We've got another one coming next week, which is The Captive. We've got another couple coming in October, a couple football movies that are also faith-based as well. So for all the people out there that are saying that they don't make movies for a Christian audience, you guys are wrong, because they do. And they, meaning multiple companies and multiple distributors, will put these out. So if there's a market out there, Hollywood's going to fill that. And they're going to profit from it as well. Now, this one is based on a book, and it's based on a true story about a guy who died in a car crash, and he says he went to heaven. That's kind of not what the movie's about, though. And here's the problem. This is not me at all disrespecting anyone's personal faith or anyone's personal journey or anyone's personal beliefs. It's me saying this movie is just frankly boring. It shouldn't be called 90 Minutes in Heaven. It should be called 90 Minutes in a Waiting Room of a Hospital, because that's what you're doing in this movie. Unlike Heaven is for Real, which came out a year or two ago with Greg Kinnear about the boy who died on the operating table and claims he had gone to heaven, seen Jesus and seen his family. That's what that movie's about. And it's about this community trying to reconcile that claim and that personal knowledge. And I found that one very interesting. This one is not at all about the 90 minutes this guy had spent in heaven or heading to heaven, which when we do get the story, it's the most literal, cliched version of heaven you've ever seen. Clouds and lights and literally pearly gates, which just to me seems very two-dimensional, I guess. But before you even get to that, it's just not, like, it's like 2 hours of this guy overcoming his injuries in the hospital and overcoming and getting surgeries and treatments. And it's how he reconciles recovery with his family. It's not about heaven. It's not even really about religion, although there is definitely a religious angle to it because he's a pastor and they bring in prayer. But it's not even about prayer. There's one point where I go, oh, this is going to be a very strong, prayerful movie. No, that's not what it was. They kind of swerve into that, and then it's him moping around. It's Hayden Christensen plays this guy, and he's got this 80s Tom Atkins mustache he's rocking, not nearly as well as Tom Atkins does. He's got this Texas drawl, which I don't know if it's authentic or not. I mean, it sounds really silly. Not as silly as Joseph Gordon-Levitt's accent from the Walk trailer that's out there right now. But ultimately, it's about him whining. I mean, he whines more in this movie than he did in Star Wars Episode 2 and 3 combined. And I just got frustrated. I got about halfway through the movie and finally I just turned on it. I'm like, I'm tired of waiting around, and just, it makes you feel like you're sitting in a waiting room. And it's just boring. It is a boring, poorly written, with the exception of the leads. I mean, Hayden Christensen's okay. Kate Bosworth is fine. You got Fred Thompson showing up. Those people are good acting. Everyone else is terrible. All the other side characters, the actors are really, really bad. And it's corny, but it doesn't even slather on the cheese to the point for people who like that, it's just sort of passively corny. Yeah, it's got the sort of that faith angle to it, but it seems almost secondary to this guy moping around and having to find himself and be able to recover from these injuries. You could do whatever you can say something I completely agree with or disagree with. You can be religious or not, or preachy or not. Just don't bore me, because that means I'm going to tell you it sucks.
It sucks.
That's it for these movie reviews. I've got a couple more on the other end of the break, and I'll also be talking about the box office and the world famous DVD roundup.
Open Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Op, 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 op. Open Gangnam Style.
Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies rolling into the final segment. Let's continue with a couple movie reviews. There are some smaller releases, both kind of genre films on their own rights. One of them actually is opening this week in limited release. I believe it's also on demand, and that is Listening. When two grad students develop a way to communicate between minds, their research is targeted by dark forces in the government.
No one's ever done this before.
What's the worst that could happen?
The only thing fast enough to decode the human brain is the human brain.
Whatever it is you're really thinking goes through the wire.
Please, God, don't let him die.
Ladies and gentlemen,
we have just invented telepathy.
The ability to read minds is a matter of national security.
What did you do?
This movie is one of those stories that finds a certain place in my heart. I love movies about people in a lab or in a scientific environment trying to figure out a way to better humanity and have it go horribly awry. We've seen movies like Splice, or Rise of the Planet of the Apes falls into this category. Even that movie, The Lazarus Effect, that really was just kind of a crappy little horror movie earlier this year, I enjoyed because I love that kind of story. I just think it's funny. I like that kind of cautionary tale. It's like a Twilight Zone episode, so I've always enjoyed those kind of movies, and that's essentially what this is. I had somebody ask me if it's like Ex Machina, and I said, no, not quite. Ex Machina is much more about artificial intelligence and the nature of consciousness. This is more about free will and actually challenging whether we can get to the point where we can read minds, or whether we can sense scientifically what's going on in somebody's head. And I mean, I don't know the neuroscience at all. I don't pretend to be a neuroscientist, even though I play one on TV. I don't know if this is even on a theory possible, but they sure make it seem so in this movie. And that's a great benefit to it, because it really feels, as you watch this movie, like they're telling you something that could actually happen. And I love that kind of speculative fiction, because it reminds me a little bit of artificial intelligence. I remember when I saw the movie Transcendence, because of my review, somebody from the local NPR station wanted to get in touch with me and have me come down and do an interview with a guy who works with artificial intelligence. We had a neat little discussion about this and whether or not it's a good thing. And the nature of this is they're able to tap into minds, and the fastest way to decode it is, of course, with another human brain. So it's a way to, can you read somebody's mind using this electronic setup? And of course, I watch this and I say, well, you know, what is going on in my head or anybody else's head? Nobody wants to know everything. The nicest person in the world, if you heard their innermost thoughts, you'd be horrified, especially somebody you love, somebody who's very close to you. And that's kind of the key to this movie, is this is not a good invention. And even if there are practical applications beyond it, you don't want to be in somebody else's head, because you get all of their ugliness as well as the stuff that's past the filter. You get everything that's caught in that filter trap that's in their head, and it's not good stuff all the time. Some people have really dark thoughts, or just unpleasant thoughts, or insulting thoughts. The middle section gets a little bit melodramatic, because it has to tell the story about this guy with his wife and their relationship, and kind of some of the struggles they're dealing with. But eventually, when it finally writes itself and gets going back on track, it works out at the end. But if you have a good start and a good ending, there's a lot that can be forgiven. And I think that that's what happens with Listening. So Listening rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
The next film I want to talk about is Contracted Phase 2. This is actually a sequel to Contracted that came out a couple years ago. A smaller horror movie, sort of a spinoff on the zombie genre, released by IFC. Contracted Phase 2, the sequel, is out now, and it's been out in limited release for a week. But again, you can also get it on demand and in your local theaters. Just check your listings. A highly infectious STD that results in zombie-like symptoms continues its outbreak in Los Angeles.
4 dead bodies and 3 missing girls. I'm just trying to put the pieces together.
Police are still looking for a connection between the brutal murders.
What exactly am I testing for?
Everything.
They are asking for anyone experiencing flu-like symptoms to immediately seek medical attention.
It's under my skin.
Ricky!
Some carmine?
I think it's time that we escalate things, don't you?
In general, I'm kind of bored with zombie movies because I don't think there's a lot of new material out there. I think this is interesting because it takes a different approach. It takes it as a bit of an outbreak film, and it takes it as a contagious disease. And of course, it's very heavy-handedly spinning off the taboos of sex and promiscuity. You see that actually happen in the movie It Follows to a much better delivery. But if you like that lower budget zombie movie, that slightly different take on the zombie genre, this one works. It has plenty of gore, and yeah, it has zombie-like action and zombie-like characters, so it fits those bills. It's not as strongly written, and there's one or two parts in there where something so absurd happens that I had trouble believing it. And I'm not talking about somebody turning into a zombie being absurd. I'm talking about how one person in particular gets infected. I remember seeing that going, well, now we're in sort of comedic territory. I mean, it almost spins off of Peter Jackson's Dead Alive. And when you see the movie, you may recognize the scene I'm talking about. It involves pudding in Peter Jackson's movie. This has some very big stumbling blocks, and it's not perfect. But if you like zombies and you can't get enough of them, and there are people who do because they got a second Walking Dead show, you might enjoy this one. So I'm going to have to say that Contracted Phase 2 kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the box office and talk about whether or not I was correct with my predictions last week. Now, last week I said there'd be $10 million for Transporter Refueled, and I said that just because I would look like a genius if it actually happened to come to fruition. It did not. The Transporter movie, it was embarrassingly bad. It did not do well at all. In fact, it came in fifth in the four-day weekend, and it came in fourth in the three-day weekend. Either way, even if you take its four-day number, it was only $9 million. The big surprise was the fact that War Room came from behind, actually made more money its second weekend, and overtook Straight Outta Compton. Not that it was a big deal to overtake Straight Outta Compton, because Straight Outta Compton has been out for almost a month, but War Room kind of had this big resurgence, which is kind of cool for a little, small, essentially independent film. I'm still not covering, mainly because I wasn't afforded an opportunity to see it. And by the time I knew it was out, my window for reviewing was over, and I didn't think it was going to win a second weekend. It's also not making, I mean, massive money. It's making a lot of money for what its budget is. Because I think it was going into the week with almost $29 million, which is actually really, really good for a small little movie like this. And it's going to top out probably with about $50 million, which is a nice chunk of change. That's not Avengers numbers. It's not the prayer version of Avatar, which made, you know, like $2 billion. And then what's actually even more impressive is A Walk in the Woods came in second, especially when you talk about the four-day weekend. When you look at the three-day weekend, A Walk in the Woods came in third, right down to Straight Outta Compton. But A Walk in the Woods did okay. It made just over $10 million over the four-day weekend. And, you know, and it was essentially what I was predicting. I was saying it was going to be this horse race between all these movies, right around $10 million. And so that's what happened. It was just War Room was the big surprise winner. This week, I think The Perfect Guy is going to win. I think that the Visit has a chance, but it's going to be front-loaded because it's a horror movie and it's going to get the kids because it's PG-13, found footage horror movie. But I think ultimately The Perfect Guy is going to win. I mean, War Room could do well, but it's got competition from 90 Minutes in Heaven as a faith-based movie. And I mean, it's not going to continue to go up. It's going to probably end up with less than $10 million over the weekend. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD roundup. First one to talk about is The Age of Adeline. That is with Blake Lively as a woman who doesn't age, which is a better movie than I thought it would be. It still is kind of boring to me because it's not my cup of tea. There's also Shocker on Blu-ray. Not that I'm a huge fan of Shocker. It was this Wes Craven movie made in like 1989 or something like that. The reason I mention is because it got a Blu-ray release and happened to be right around the time Wes Craven passed away. He passed away last week, so I thought it was worth a mention. Also in the horror movie front is The Editor, which is from Shout Factory, and it's by the guys who did Father's Day. Now, I couldn't get through Father's Day when I actually tried to watch it, but this one I found interesting because it's a homage to the 70s and 80s giallo horror movies from Italy. Stuff like Dario Argento and Lucio Fulci, these maverick directors that most normal people in America don't know who they are, but they did these dream logic bizarre movies from the 70s. They're interesting and fun for what they are. I have a friend who's a big fan of the Italian horror movies from the 70s and 80s. I'm not a huge fan, but I appreciate it. I've seen enough of them to watch this movie and say, oh, they nailed the costume. They nailed the melodrama of acting. They nailed the dream logic. They nailed the lighting. They nailed the violence that you saw in these movies, except the blood should be red paint blood, and it's still regular stage blood now. If you don't know anything about giallo horror movies, this movie is going to make no sense to you. And that's okay, because it's not made for you. It's made for fans of giallo horror. There's also Avengers Age of Ultron is getting its on-demand release, which you can also get the special features. This is in advance of its October 2nd disc date. And then on TV, there's a whole bunch of stuff. You've got Gotham Season 1, Homeland Season 4, Supernatural Season 10, and Brooklyn Nine-Nine Season 2. That's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Black Mass, Captive, and The Maze Runner, The Scorch Trials. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.